This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a classic text or a concept we hope will shed light on the world around you. And this week, we have a guest, someone who's going to help us think through something that's central to life in this part of the world. Stephen Pelayo is an assistant professor of language and literature at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. And he's going to walk us through the idea of face from a sociolinguistic perspective.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen, you know, this is something that actually people in Malaysia would say on a kind of everyday level. We say, you know, jaga muka, I think it was the Malay equivalent, or, you know,
safe face.
Yeah. But you're going to raise the level of discourse on the question of face, aren't you, by placing it within some sort of social science framework or a linguistic framework.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the idea of face is that it comes from this metaphor that we use in day-to-day life about how we want to represent ourselves in society. So we start off with this concept of face that we sort of have this everyday common sense knowledge of, the one that you're talking about here, and then we're trying to use it in a useful way in sociology or sociolinguistics. I'm a linguist, so the idea of face comes out of sociology, but we try to employ it in linguistics to talk about politeness in particular, and that's sort of the thing that I'm mainly interested in.
Why would a linguist be interested in a phenomenon like this? You would seem to be, I mean, maybe, you know, for us who don't know the profession or the discipline, linguistics seems to be about language and things like grammar and syntax and all those other components of language.
Yeah, I think it depends sort of on how you conceive of linguistics, and sort of there's this the stream of linguists that would, for formal linguists who see themselves as being primarily interested in language and in syntax and in the sentence as the object of study. I'm not really that person. For me, what I'm interested in as a sociolinguist or as a person doing research using language is looking at sort of social phenomena, whatever it is that you're looking at, and saying, okay, why is this happening? Why is this event happening? And what can the use of language tell us about the social interaction that's happening? And that kind of sociolinguistics is a mixture then of a sociological approach to language, and then using the tools of linguistics to help us understand what's happening.
So I presume with something like face, even language is defined a bit differently in this context, because you're not talking about grammar, you're talking about expressions in a broader way.
Right. I think the kind of the thing that I would talk about is interaction, right? Interaction between people, and language is, of course, a part of that. The structure of language is, of course, an important thing, and how we talk to each other, how we form sentences is an important thing. But it's only one part of social interaction. So instead of sort of focusing on the structure of a sentence only, we're also interested in sort of other things that could help us understand the context of something. So you could think of it sort of like this way. If I insult you, if I say something bad to you, not that I would, but if I use it.
Go on, call me chubby.
Well, I was trying to think of examples here of insults that would be
hurtful.
Okay to
yeah,
use.
That would be deeply hurtful.
That would be
Stephen.
It would be hurtful, but wouldn't be too offensive thing that you could say on the radio. But if I said to you, and I would never say this to you in the real world, but let's say I called you an idiot, right? I said you're an idiot. As a linguist, you could be interested in that structure of that sentence, you're an idiot, right? And why you put it together in that way. But as the kind of sociolinguistic perspective, I would be interested in a couple of other things, right? I'd be interested in the context of why we're saying it, right? From a sort of a sociological perspective, you'd also be interested in sort of what is the context that's surrounding something. And that context could include my personal context of being the kind of person that I am, whether it's a racial context or a class context. It could be my role in a certain situation, you know, whether or not, let's say, for example, I'm at your restaurant and you're serving me, and maybe that could be a context that would be important. It could also be important that I've had a bad day, right? Had an argument with my daughter or something, and I've sort of bummed out, and I'm sort of on edge to be in a position to to complain about things or to insult people. So as a linguist, I'm interested in language, but I'm also interested in all these other things that are happening around that context and trying to explain what's happening.
Presumably that will include the cultural context of what idiocy and intelligence means,
right,
given a particular
And it would seem also that you're not talking necessarily just about individuals and an individual expression, but you're interested in broad patterns.
Well, it's about the individual in a larger context. So you have those two things are sort of happening at the same time. So in particular, I'm interested in sort of antagonism on the internet, particularly on YouTube, right? And people insulting each other on YouTube. And if you look at people insulting each other on YouTube, the context of it, so in terms of cultural context, is a bit strange, right? Because you don't here we are, we're sitting in Malaysia, we're talking in a particular place, and we're all aware of the place that we are, we're sitting together. On the internet, that's a little bit harder to kind of deduce, right? Because you're talking on YouTube in particular, you're talking to a camera and you're addressing YouTube as a place, but there's really no cultural context there. It's very hard to kind of understand what your viewer would understand and what you understand. The interesting thing that happens then on YouTube is that people, in communicating with each other, create this online culture of a YouTube community that they understand. And then what face means in that particular context is something that's emergent. It's created by the interaction of people over time. So it becomes a really interesting new context for interaction and for thinking about things like face, how you present yourself in front of this new context.
And what strikes me immediately is how you would even pin down the self in those contexts, because what do you have except a moniker, you know, kind of a name or something?
A little avatar.
You know, it might not include a real image of yourself. Because even if it has a real person as an image, it could be stolen or taken from somewhere else.
That's right.
There could be a name that suggests some ethnic identity, but it might not. Or gender identity, which might not be your real one.
Or could be like your Sherrod is a cat, right? You have a picture of a cat?
I do, indeed. Thanks for outing me. Okay. But yeah, well, that's what I mean. So
right.
And when people, in fact, interact, they're kind of interacting blind, or they are acting based on a presumed identity rather than the real one.
Yeah, although we say that this is sort of the case online, that there's this idea that you can present yourself any way that you want to. There's this famous New Yorker cartoon where I believe it's a dog was using the computer, and he says, you know, that nobody knows you're a dog online or nobody knows you're a cat online. but that sort of assumes that, like, in our day-to-day life, that everybody knows who we are. And actually, we present different personas in our own life as well. So I'm depending on where you meet me on a given day, I'm assistant professor of language and literature, which sounds, you know, nice and prestigious. But I'm also daddy part of the day. I'm also husband to my wife sometimes. I'm all these different things. So depending on the context, your persona actually shifts. And this idea that you can get to some sort of authentic or real you, I think is it's problematic, right? So if we take this into the context of YouTube or the internet, we have to think not only that we're just presenting this new online persona, but it's one of the many personas that we have in our lives. YouTube is interesting, though, because, you know, it's not just an avatar, right? I guess you can present, if you want to make a YouTube video where you don't show your face, it's possible for you to do that. But at least in the videos that I do my analysis of, it's people standing in front of a camera, talking to the camera, and addressing people. And there's, obviously, you're choosing what to record, and you're choosing where to record, and you're choosing what to say, but it is still you. It's not a picture of a cat.
But it's also the comment section of the video that you're interested in, right?
And
that's
right.
Where things get a little fuzzier, because it's not a video response,
right.
It's a written response.
Right, right.
Where does the gaze come into this? Because, I mean, I like that clarification you made about how our everyday self that we represent in a sort of, you know, physical presence is subject to the gaze of everyone else,
right,
which you don't get in YouTube.
Yeah.
Right? What's at stake there?
That's an interesting question, because on the internet, in theory, you're talking to everyone and no one at the same time, right? Because the address that someone, when someone's talking to the camera, maybe over time, and the kind of the people that I'm looking at have been making videos for a long time, and they've been getting comments for a long time, so they have an idea of what kind of people are watching them, right? But the extent to which an individual YouTuber is trying to present themselves in a particular way for a particular audience I think it depends on the YouTuber. So again, we're talking about how they want to be perceived to the people who are viewing them, and to the extent that they can imagine the viewer, sort of talking about imagined gaze almost. Who do you think is watching you, and who do you think is looking at you? I think in some way they're presenting themselves for those people. Now, with the comments section, of course, you have the real people who you are presenting yourself to, and you'll have a mixture, obviously, of people who support you and the people who very much don't support you. And I think that as we're thinking about this interaction over time, I told you I'm interested not just in individual instances of sentences or individual instances of language. I'm interested in what happens over time. It becomes a really interesting thing to say, okay, you have this set of comments here, and you can do analysis of these comments here, but let's look at the next video or the next set of videos. How does the person then change in response to that, which does happen.
Why did you choose that type of video? Why not just any video? And for instance, you know, I remember reading or trawling through the comments following NameWee's, you know, Malaysia Cuckoo video, which, you know, drew, you know, thousands, really, literally thousands of responses, and vitriolic, angry, you know, attempts sometimes to be rational. But, you know, really, there was a whole range of things. Would that be a subject for analysis, and how would it be different from the type of video that you're looking at?
Yeah, certainly that could be a topic of analysis. And like I said, since I'm interested in this over time, I would be interested in looking at how one video starts off as a video that someone makes, and then the responses to it can generate interest about it and generate interest on the site, but also in other places. It becomes a kind of phenomenon, right, that grows into something, you know, larger than just a video. Again, in talking about sort of taking into account context in a larger sort of a larger understanding of context, it's very important when we look at videos that say, okay, why did this video go viral, for example? You have to look at a lot of different things that are impacting it to sort of understand why that is. You'd asked why I was interested in a particular group of people that I was interested in. It actually started as a personal interest. I was interested in discussions between atheists and Christians, and yeah, I was interested in looking at these arguments and seeing that people never seemed to change their mind. That was one thing that I was interested in. I was also interested in the fact that the argument seemed to go on and on without anyone changing positions or without any sort of resolution at all. And I was also interested in how personal it got. So people would be arguing with each other, and very quickly, if you're looking at atheists and Christians arguing with each other on YouTube, it's not about questions of theology. May start off as that, but very quickly becomes about, you know, who's a bad person and who's a good person. And those bad people and good people is never limited to just Christians hanging out together or atheists hanging out together. Actually, they end up fighting. There's a lot of infighting within these groups as well. And so I was interested, again, at looking at things over time. So what happens in this community of users? So why do they make affiliations that they do, and why do those affiliations change over time?
The default reaction people have towards the comment section of a YouTube post is that it's just going to be full of bile. There's not going to be much constructive comments there. Is that true? Do you find that there is actually a new kind of discourse that's taking place? Is there something beyond that perception?
So the research that I've been working on, a particular project right now, is YouTube about 3 or 4 years ago. And that's a particular kind of YouTube comment that's happening there. YouTube has just recently, however, changed their policy to connect YouTube comments to their Google Plus social media thing. And their idea is that what you say, you know, it's all this bile, we're going to try to clean it up some way. And the idea for them was that they're going to tie it to your real name, right? So you have to out yourself, essentially, and then you'll be less likely to be mean. And so far, it hasn't been successful, because people can choose any name that they want to. So it hasn't worked yet.
Okay, so, you know, the revolution might not happen on YouTube. I think some of us had an inkling that this was going to be the case. You've been listening to Stephen Pillaya, Ahmad Fuad Rahman, myself, Sharad Kutin. We are talking about the issue of face from a sociolinguistic perspective. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. And Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and Stephen Pelaya. He's Assistant Professor of Language and Literature at University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. And the question is face.
Yes.
Okay, so now you kind of laid out some of the parameters in terms of your research interests and the object of your research.
Right.
But what are the conceptual tools that you bring to this analysis?
Okay, so if we're talking about face, let's talk about face in particular. And so face is how you want to be perceived in front of the world, right? And this is Irvin Goffman's concept that it starts in sociology. So moving on from Goffman, then, the idea is that we have positive face and negative face. So negative face is the idea that we don't want to be impeded in what we're doing. And the idea of positive face is that we want people to like us. We want people to do to help us do the kinds of things that we want to get done. If we're thinking about this on the internet, this is sort of the topic that I've been interested in. Basically, to be liked is to have views, I guess, on YouTube, on Twitter. To be liked is to have a lot of followers, and to not have your opinion impeded at all. You don't want to have people attack you. You don't want to have people making angry comments in your comment section on Twitter. I guess you don't want people responding to you in an angry way. So these are the kinds of things that we're trying to balance. But we have this really interesting thing on the internet called hate, right? You know, you have people hating on other people, right? And though we're saying positive face is the idea that you want people to like you and to like what you're doing, there's actually some positive value placed on being hated, right? If 90% of the people don't like you and 10% of the people do like you, there's an idea that you're this kind of prophet, right? That the majority of people don't get it, right? So it is actually complicated. It's not a very simple dichotomy that you just want to be liked and you want to be able to do whatever you want to do. There's actually this idea of being hated can be a good thing on the internet.
I think a lot of politicians in Malaysia, well, there's some politicians whose names I will not mention, who I think kind of thrive on that. They really love the controversy. Yeah. They set out, in fact, to create hateful responses, and that seems to be a sign of their success, that they have somehow breached this barrier of politeness that, mm-hmm. you know, much of Malaysian politics apparently is encased in.
How much do these faces that you describe converge with, you know, temperament and personalities in outside of the social media world? I mean, what are the conclusions that come out from studies of comparison of attitudes there? I mean, do these reflect a kind of strategy, or is it a bit more complex than that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing to talk about. So in the analysis that I've done in looking at particular evangelical Christians, and this hate thing is an important thing for them, because they see being hated by the world. They actually go back to the scripture, to the Bible, where it says Jesus is talking and says that you shouldn't be surprised when people hate you for doing what I say, right? And so they can go back to the Bible and say, okay, the reason I'm being hated here is I'm behaving like Jesus wants me to behave, which is sort of a tricky thing, right? What's the difference between being hated for being a jerk and being hated for being righteous, you know? I think also the same thing then applies to these politicians, right? There's a fine line between being righteous and being a jerk, right? And the person who's righteous in one person's eyes is a jerk in another person's eyes. So it's complicated by the fact that we have different people looking at us, right? Mm-hmm. And we're being perceived by different people. Now, if we're in this sort of world where everyone's the same, we all have the same opinions, and it's actually quite a simple thing, right? You're liked by everyone or you're not liked by everyone. But actually, it's more complicated than that, because we have so many different constituents, essentially. And so in politics, you see this in terms of different parties or different racial groups, or however you want to look at it, different religious groups. On YouTube, you could see sort of the same kind of things, different constituents of the people that you want to appeal to, and the people that maybe being hated by is a good thing.
The significance of much of this, I think, rests on, you know, this idea that somehow media can replicate or create structures for dialogue, that there can be something like communicative rationality, that we can, the most reasonable argument wins the day.
Right.
Or, you know, that you're not about to hate somebody, you just disagree with them.
Right.
Right. It's not that they're obnoxious or a jerk, it's that they have their argument wrong.
Right.
But what we find is actually not that, or it's a complex mix of emotional, the emotional dimension to the reasoned argument,
right?
As much as anything else, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is like real life, though. I mean, how often does the most logical argument, the most reasoned argument, that's the one that wins out? I mean, that's never the end of an election coverage is. And tonight we've found out what the most logical, reasonable answer to the question is, right? That's not what people are looking for. People are looking for the most convincing or the most attractive or the thing that fits their ideology in the best way. I think that we have this sort of conception of the internet as being potentially utopian, right? Where everybody can say anything they want and get their message out there, and we can have this fair exchange of ideas, as opposed to, you know, people in comment sections calling you a Nazi, right? Unfortunately, that's not the way that it seems to go. That unregulated, these places become, I don't know, bile-filled, is to use your word. They're not generally positive places, and it's not generally a way for people to have these fair exchange of ideas. I don't know if that says more about the medium or it says more about people just in general. I tend to think that actually that's the way that people are, and the medium just gives us a way of seeing it.
So to what extent would you say that the much of the antagonism that you encounter in your research is just a reflection of the kind of pent-up sentiments that humans will not express ordinarily?
This is an interesting thing about face in particular, and when you think about different contexts, you know, I started with this example of if I call you an idiot, right? And it's kind of uncomfortable or funny in this situation because I would never say that to your face. Like, why? It would be a really inappropriate thing for me to say, and particularly in this context, I mean, everyone would be outraged, right? But when you have something that's sort of removing us from each other, and we're putting a computer between us, or we're putting some sort of way for me not to be able to see your reaction to that, it actually makes it easier, I think, for me to share my true feelings or to act out in a way that isn't mediated at all by what I feel is my need to sort of present myself in a positive way. It's not a question about whether or not we're really the one way or really another way. I think that just given different particular technologies, we will behave in different ways depending on the context.
But is there a wider social message that we can draw from here in that, and people are more frequently pointing out to this, that it is in many ways dehumanizing us because... Right. Especially now that communication technology is more accessible to younger people,
right?
Now that this is seen to be more efficient and more cost-effective, that people are just preferring the electronic route, that we are being slowly robbed of the kind of just basic everyday human face-to-face interaction that is really more enriching.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, in terms of sort of my research, I'm not really interested so much in how things should be as much as I'm interested in how things are. And I think that people who say, oh, we should try to do one thing and not the other, I think it's really difficult when we have people who are interested in using technologies like YouTube. Now, we've been talking about YouTube, but if you think about Facebook for a second, Facebook is a much, much different place than YouTube. And Facebook comments with your friends, you wouldn't ever... I think for the most part, I don't know what kind of friends you have, but most people wouldn't describe their Facebook comments as bile-filled, right? Because you kind of, it's people you know, actually, in real life. Most of the time, it's people you know in real life. And actually, I think about my Facebook interactions, they are largely positive. And when it's negative, it's a very strange type of thing, right? Because we have the relationships that we have with people on Facebook are oftentimes things that we have in real life as well. So it's not necessarily an either or here. You have relationships that are primarily online. You have relationships that are primarily offline. And you have relationships that are a mix of two. Over the years, now that Facebook's been available, I've had friends who I had in real life and in sort of my physical location that now are for 4 years we've been interacting primarily on Facebook, and now they're primarily internet friends. I actually don't remember where I met them sometimes. So to sort of see this as a dichotomy, we have one thing and the other, it's actually not the way that it is anymore.
Yeah, I think, you know, that argument about, say, you know, the loss of the face-to-face interaction, I mean, letters. I mean, we have, in fact, we now have a rather nostalgic view of the letter written on paper, you know, perhaps in, you know, kind of ink, you know, and in cursive, is now become a sign of some really humanizing period in human history, in human communication. And but I do want to come back to the question of face, because it seems to be there's an important distinction to be made between one's presenting an idea, trying to communicate something, having a message, and underscoring that the presentation of yourself. So, and aren't those two things distinct?
Well, I think it kind of depends on how you see the world. I mean, I from my perspective, I think it's very, very hard to sort of draw those two things apart from each other, to say that there's some sort of idealized message that exists apart from the embodied experience of someone delivering it to us. Whenever we have an idea or we have a message, it always comes from somebody who always has a social stake, who's always performing in some way. I don't think that there's really any way that we can ever divorce the two from each other. Ideas are embodied things. They come from people. And because they come from people, they're always socially situated.
Now, do we, this is a moment for our own sort of self-criticism and reflection. We have this show that's been going almost a year, and we're presenting ideas of dead thinkers, philosophers, you know, social theorists, and we very rarely focus on its embodiment in a person. So we sometimes talk about the time in which these ideas emerge. Sometimes we get into the biographical details.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, but we don't ever, and is that something we need to, do you think we need to do that? Do you think we can, in fact, ever present ideas, especially because they come in book form for the most part, right?
And I think personally, too, I am very wary of the kind of reductive routes that these, of pointing out these external factors to the ideas can sometimes lead to. Because sometimes we just want to reduce an idea to a time or to the kind of, to the traumas the thinker had during a childhood or something. I mean, I know I'm not saying that's what you do, but there is sometimes that slippery slope when we emphasize the situationality too much.
Yeah, I think it's slippery slope is an interesting metaphor. I think that we need to take these sorts of things into account, but we need to do so in a critical way as well. So if you're just saying we're reducing someone's thought because of we read something into what happened in their childhood, I mean that's a problem as well. But it does matter if our ideas are coming from people from a privileged class at a particular time. Who saw the world from a privileged point of view. I think it's fair to say we should be critical of what they say because of that. Or we should think or be aware of the other ideas that probably didn't survive because they weren't privileged. I don't think that it has to be an either-or situation, but I do think we have to be aware of it. Now, talking about ideas over time, the interesting thing about these ideas is that they begin in a person at a particular time, and you have a book that's written at a particular time and read by a particular group of people. But once the time starts to go forward and that book starts to travel through time, it takes on a history of its own, right? And the idea comes to us through a long history of different people delivering it and sharing it in different ways. And to be aware of those sorts of things, I think, is really, really important. Again, I've been talking about context. You know, we need to understand our context in history, and we need to understand the context of ideas in history. And then as they progress, I don't think that knowing that damages our dealing with the idea at all. I just think it helps us understand it even more so.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to the analysis of face on online, what is it that you do eventually? I mean, is it purely descriptive, or where can you take that if it's not just descriptive?
Yeah, just a question that's parallel to that. What is fieldwork online like?
Okay.
Because when you talk about sociologists, there's a range of variables that they can tap into, whereas online work, it seems that it's more visual. Is it more impressionistic? Perhaps you can share some experience.
It's less sweaty, I imagine. You don't have to go anywhere.
It can be quite sweaty. I'll tell you what. Okay, so the first question of what you can do with it, that's an interesting question, I think. It's a larger question about whether or not research is valuable if it can be applied or not applied. Now, I'm interested in interreligious dialogue. Interreligious is an interesting way to describe atheists and Christians speaking to each other, because atheists we're not talking about a religion necessarily there. But if we're talking about interreligious dialogue, I think that it's interesting to try to figure out when and where arguments happen, and when and where things become negative, very negative. And I think if we can pinpoint those situations and say, okay, if we're looking at this argument between these two people, where did it get nasty, and where do people start taking sides, and trying to pick that apart, I think helps us be a little bit more more aware of why people disagree with each other, and to the extent that then we can apply that for a positive discourse between people. Ideally, what I would like to see people do is to take that information, and people who are interested in interreligious dialogue, then to apply that and say, okay, how can we create or help facilitate positive communication? And people actually doing interreligious dialogue can say, okay, how can I take the information that I've learned here and do my best to not be a jerk to other people? In terms of a field work online, there's a couple of different approaches to this. A sociolinguist at the University of Hamburg called Yanis Androtsopoulos, and he has a 2008 article about discourse-centered online ethnography, is what his term is, discourse-centered online ethnography. And in discourse-centered online ethnography, there's sort of two parts to it. One is that you are looking at language in a particular context, but it's from an ethnographic perspective. And an ethnographic perspective is trying to look at a social context over time, but also have this insider perspective on it as well. So instead of just saying, okay, I'm going to go and see what these people are doing and do an analysis of it, it's trying to understand the experience of those people. And that involves talking to them and interviewing them and doing that sort of thing to really understand the experience from both sides, and then doing kind of analysis of discourse inside of that. In my research, I've been really unsuccessful in interviewing people because they're very, at least in the group of people that I was looking at, not a lot of people wanted to talk to me. So I wouldn't argue that I take an ethnographic perspective. I'm not trying to get the perspective of people within the community. I do take a longitudinal perspective, which means I look at it over time, and I look at how a group develops over time. But in terms of being in the YouTube community, there's actually a lot of different roles you can take in a YouTube community, and being a viewer is one legitimate role, people who view but don't interact. And I sort of see myself as a YouTube viewer. I'm sort of a person who experiences YouTube as from a third perspective, but doesn't get engaged then in what people are actually doing.
And you call it, is there a name for it, like stalker or something?
Lurker is the word. I've actually, if someone has said this to me before, you're lurking, aren't you? And again, it's much different on YouTube, because I think lurking has this idea, there's this community and you're sort of watching, you're sort of creepily following someone on Facebook.
It's negative.
It's a negative thing, yes. But on YouTube, the idea is that you're putting out a video for people to watch, not necessarily to comment on. If you look at how many comments a video has versus how many views, many more people are viewing the video rather than just commenting on it. So I resist the negative word lurk. I'm not this sort of creepy person in the dark following people around. I'd like to think of myself as a viewer as opposed to a lurker.
I like the lurking. I think you should. Your next big creepy book, Stephen, is going to be lurking. You know, the political economy
lurking
of, you know,
faces.
Yeah, yeah. Lurking, research, yeah. Something like that.
How to creep people out online. There's a subtitle for that one.
Yeah. We come to the end of this fascinating discussion. Where would you direct people to in terms of reading? Would you tell them pick up Goffman, the presentation itself, or would you say do something from the linguistic side?
Well, it kind of depends on what you're interested in. I think if you're interested in sort of the beginning of it, the Goffman is a good place to start. If you're interested in particularly in politeness, there's a Brown and Levinson book called, I believe it's called Politeness, Some Universals in Human Interaction, and that's a 1987 book. It's a little bit dated now, particularly that title, Some Universals in Human Interaction, and there's a lot of criticism of the idea of faces that it doesn't take into context. Now you can say that there are universals about human interaction is a little bit dated now, but that's a good starting point to say how have linguists taken this idea of face and how have we applied it in our work. If you're interested in the Androtsopoulos article, that is available online at a journal called Language and then the @ Internet. Androtsopoulos' article is from 2008, and I have an article in 2011 about people arguing online. All those are available free online if you'd like to check those out.
You have a book in the works too, correct?
I do, yes. I have a monograph coming out on Bloomsbury next year called Antagonism on YouTube. It is just being finished now. Hopefully it's being finished while I'm on the radio here. I'd like to think that it's writing itself. But yes, it should be out sometime next year if I manage to get it together.
Right. So our listeners can actually perhaps email you at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or interact with you on Facebook. Are you on Facebook?
I am on Facebook.
You have a
yes.
Twitter too.
I do have a Twitter as well. Yes.
Are you a member of the growing community of Night School on Facebook?
Is this a trick question? No, I'm not.
Must join.
I think the problem is if you let me in.
Are you slightly embarrassed? Do I see you blushing?
I am blushing my face. Yeah, I'm a little bit embarrassed. The problem is if you join me into your community, I might end up lurking as well and analyzing what you're saying.
Okay, very good.
I think can use a few lurkers. I mean, it's been quiet lately.
I like the idea. I really like.
Most online communities like a little bit of controversy. So I'm happy to join and stir things up if that will make things better.
Everything makes it better. Stephen, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is my son Absalom, and Absalom is spelled A-B-S-A-L-O-M.
Ah,
one word.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's Absalom.
Absalom. It's a Faulkner, William Faulkner reference. Yeah, back from my literature days. Yeah,
wonderful. And Fuad, you're not a convert to Twitter yet,
no,
are you?
No, not yet.
Stephen Mumford almost made him convert.
Got him.
Yeah, almost got him. You know, you say you're interested in dialogue and how dialogue transforms people.
Yeah,
almost happened to Fuad.
Well, this is the problem about Twitter. Actually, so I've given out my Twitter handle, which I'm so slightly embarrassed about, because it's just me complaining about my day-to-day life and my interaction with my children.
Oh, I'm not following you.
But it could be interesting. I do have a very interesting day-to-day
life. But I know, Stephen, you follow me.
I do, yes.
And I'm at Sharad Chitin, and I try to keep it political. I don't do very much personal stuff on Twitter.
Well, I've had this problem, I think, in my life, is that I grew up in sort of the age of the internet, and I blog a lot as well, and so I'm just unable to sort of see this distinction between personal and professional life. It has yet to hurt me, but maybe this is the beginning. This is the beginning of my my potential ruin as a person who can't keep.
And what's your blog? You said you have one. What's the URL?
My URL is the same as the Twitter handle, mysonabsalom.com. So yeah, again, this could be the undoing of that, but. We'll see. Well,
reversal's good.
It is. Is it
good? I'm told.
Okay. Well, I'll happily welcome many lurkers into my online life.
Thank you very much. That was Stephen Pillaya. He is assistant professor of language and literature at the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. We've been talking about FACE with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and I'm Sharad Kutin on Night School, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.